From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a thing.
It's time for Plan B for Lebanon, Iraq, and America's women. Plus, a decade of welfare reform and... Republicans ask if the president is, this is their word, an idiot. Hello again and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, public radio's civilized yet provocative antidote to the screaming talking heads that dominate political debate. I'm Lawrence O'Donnell, sitting in as moderator for the vacationing Matt Miller. With me here in our Santa Monica World headquarters is our resident leftist Robert Scheer, editor of the investigative website truthdig.com. and author of Playing President. Joining us from Washington, D.C. today is our reliable right-winger and my McLaughlin Group sparring partner, Tony Blankley. Tony is the editorial page editor of The Washington Times and author of The West's Last Chance. And the fearless Arianna Huffington has just flown in from the blogosphere to join us here in Santa Monica. Arianna is the publisher of the mostly political blog HuffingtonPost.com. Her new book is... On Becoming Fearless in Love, Work, and Life. I wish we had 30 minutes for that, Arianna. But Tony, the French have finally ponied up. They've pledged 2,000 troops to go into Lebanon. Italy has pledged 3,000. And is it time for you in the France-hating party to admit that France is indeed doing a highly helpful thing to world order, especially since the reason for their delay in making the pledge was that they were negotiating stronger, tougher rules of engagement that would permit the peacekeepers to use deadly force?
Oh, I thought they were trying to negotiate with the Italians to see who got to wear the general's cap on this group.
And well, that's ongoing at the moment, actually.
Yes, right. Yeah, there's sort of an opera bouffe aspect to this. They also undercut the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, in that they had originally agreed, and America conceded to their taking the lead in the drafting of Resolution 1701, that they would lead a group, a force of 15,000, of which they would contribute a very substantial share. They then came in with a princely number of 200, upped it to 400. Then the Italians came in with 8,000. Then the French came up to 2,000. The Italians came down to 3,000, and they're haggling over who gets to be general. I do agree with you that the one good thing Chirac has been doing on this has been negotiating the right for the soldiers to have bullets in their guns. However, I am dubious of this whole process, and all of this delay is making it less likely that the ceasefire will be successfully maintained.
Arianna, given that the United States is capable at the moment of contributing exactly zero soldiers to this endeavor, is it time for us to say thank you to the French?
I think it's time for us to say thank you to the French and goodbye to the Iraqis, because that's really at the heart of all the problems. It's like we cannot discuss anything at the moment. We cannot discuss the ceasefire in Lebanon or welfare reform here, or health care here, or education here, or Katrina, or anything without discussing Iraq. And that is really the defining issue of our time. And for us to be sort of a bystander in all these negotiations because we don't have the forces to contribute is really just another tragic indication of how much our policy in Iraq has failed.
Look, I just have to say that some of us can discuss other topics without bringing up Iraq.
Well, I know you but discussion is meaningless.
You haven't shown that yet, but the reason that America does not participate in peacekeeping forces is because of our high controversy, everybody understands that it's not useful to put Americans in there any more than it would be useful to put Israelis or other controversial neutral nation. So we do an awful lot in logistics
but
on all these operations,
and we fight the wars,
and then others come in to clean
but
it up.
Do you realize how absurd what you said is? That America, this country that used to be loved all around the world. When I was growing up in Greece, we used to have statues of Truman everywhere. This country that was worshipped and revered, and everybody wanted to come and be here, is now so detested that cannot participate in peacemaking missions. What is amazing is this tyranny of low expectations, as Bush used to call it, has now become the norm.
Tony, hold on a second. Let me let Bob gang up on you. Bob, go ahead. Jump in.
I don't want to gang up on Tony. I agree the United States is controversial at this time, and I believe in this administration is not the only one made it controversial, but certainly did it exponentially. I would point out that in the Mideast, that the French and the English used to be considered the big colonizers. In time of the Suez campaign, the U.S. Actually took a position of neutrality. And even during the Six-Day War, they kept all their lines open. So the United States had a great deal of credibility in the Mideast as opposed to the old colonial powers. We were supposed to represent something different. And I do think it represents a very serious reversal of the perception of the United States, that we would not be trusted by the Lebanese, who, by the way, we celebrated their election. Our president, our secretary of state, said the Lebanese election was an example of how their policy was working, democracy was flowering, and so forth. And the idea that Americans couldn't be part of this is sad. The other thing is we should thank the French, because, in fact, after their colonial experience, they came to their senses, and they understand that it doesn't pay guarding the oil lines for other people like the Chinese to get the oil. Is not a good deal. And in fact, the French have done both the Israelis and the United States a great favor by, first of all, brokering this deal, getting the ceasefire. It's a face-saving thing. The Israelis were enabled by the United States into an adventure that turned out to be absolutely disastrous. It is their biggest military defeat. It has weakened Israel's position, very much endangered their security. And I blame their being enabled by the United States, which told them we'll never go for a ceasefire. And then they betrayed them, and they turned to the French to bail them out, and that's what the French are doing.
Holding to Ariana's notion that we can't talk about anything without talking about Iraq, let's talk about Iraq. Congressman Christopher Shays, running for his life and re-election in Connecticut, and suffering it may be a bit from the Lamont surge there, has returned from his 14th trip in Iraq to announce that he is cutting and running from the Bush position on Iraq. He now says that my view is that it may be that the only way we are able to encourage some political will on the part of the Iraqis is to have a timeline for troop withdrawal. Tony, this is a very familiar note to me. This is was the Republican notion 10 years ago on welfare reform, which we will come to in a minute, where they basically gave a timeline to people on welfare saying, in effect, grow up within a certain time period or we're abandoning you. Shays, following that Republican line of thought, has applied it to Iraq. He's reversed his position completely. He'd never, by the way, mentioned the word Lamont in his announcement about his change of position for Connecticut voters. Is this the first of a bunch we are going to see between now and November 7th as Republican congressmen start to worry about how their voters are seeing this?
I think that's possible. Chris is someone who I've had a very friendly relationship with over the years. I was a little sad, not because of the substance that reasonable people can disagree on, but that my sense is, and I haven't talked to him since he's made the statement, my sense is that he did it out of a political calculation, that there's nothing particularly new between the 14th and the 13th trip to have changed his view. And I don't think usually that 11th hour switches of position for what would appear to be political expediency's sake work. I think it's better to stand your ground and maintain your integrity. And while perhaps he saw something this time that shocked him that didn't shock him in the previous 13 trips, I think this was a political mistake on Chris's part.
Ariana, would you like to take this opportunity to endorse Chris Shays for re-election as a Republican in Connecticut now that he has joined the John Murtha Caucus on Iraq in the House of Representatives?
I would like to say how interesting it is that Chris Shays is joining Chuck Hagel. And they're becoming like now the two most prominent outspoken Republicans on the Jack Murtha position, way ahead of other prominent Democrats like Hillary Clinton and Schumer and others who are still trying to maintain the Bush light position. So this kind of realignment interests me very much because it shows that on this very important issue, the right-left way of looking at our political landscape is not really very useful.
Bob Scheer, Ken Melman, the chairman of the Republican Party, has not yet rushed to the microphone to condemn Republican Christopher Shays for cutting and running. Is this, you know, I have to say that when Jack Murtha first took that position, I thought, okay, this is the beginning of what will be a mushrooming group over time. Do you think there's going to be more of this in a significant way between now and November for Republicans who are running for their reelection seats?
Well, I think it's a big issue for Republicans. It's also a big issue for Democrats. Where do they stand on this war? And I agree with Arianna. It's not a left-right issue. If you are a serious conservative, and Bill Buckley, not to jump the gun on your condemnation of Bush later on in the show, but Bill Buckley and others have said the Iraq war is a disaster and you have to get out. And this would have been a traditional conservative position to shun foreign adventures, to not, you know, George Washington warned against these foreign entanglements. So it's a betrayal of really those conservative values to embrace this sort of neocon agenda or the neoliberal agenda, the DLC agenda. And I just want to point out one thing. There is a big debate going on in the Democratic Party. You still have the people who want to do more. You know, you have Ken Pollack and Daniel Byman writing in the Washington Post last week. They say, first of all, they concede the war is a disaster. They say the war in Iraq, I'm quoting, the war in Iraq has proved to be a disaster for the struggle against Osama bin Laden, which after all was the reason for it. Fighters there are receiving training, building networks, and becoming further radicalized, and the U.S. occupation is proving a dream recruiting tool for young Muslims worldwide. That's Kenneth Pollack, who supported the war on the Democratic side. Yeah, what does he say? What are they saying in their column? Put 450,000 troops in there to prevent to settle this war. So you have a debate going on in the Democratic Party, and I hope there'll be one in the Republican Party, and it should be basically between people who want to reject these foreign adventures that cost American lives and destroy our reputation in the world.
Tony, Chris Shays didn't just announce a reversal of position. He's also announced that he's going to hold, in his subcommittee, he's going to hold three hearings titled Iraq, Democracy or Civil War. What is going to happen within the Republican Party after Labor Day when Chris Shays gets back to Washington, the Congress is in session, and he has scheduled hearings that clearly this administration and this congressional leadership will not want? You've worked in that House. You never had a renegade subcommittee chairman running hearings that the speaker didn't want when you were working for Newt Gingrich there. How are they going to handle this?
I think this will be better covered by the media than any of his previous hearings. the media is going to love this. He is obviously taking an opposition position to Bush, and it will be embarrassing to the Republicans and to the president. I mean, there's no other way to analyze it.
Arianna, will what Shays doing and will his high-profile hearings completely neutralize any Bush rhetoric about what cutting and running means or what a timetable for leaving Iraq means?
Absolutely. It's incredibly significant. And also, you know, Chris Shays cannot be easily dismissed as just somebody doing it for political expediency because he has a history of having been a maverick in the past and a history of integrity. And what also is going to be interesting is how Democrats are going to respond. How are they going to be become more hawkish than Chris Shays? Are they going to attack his position as being not sufficiently protecting American interests? So it's going to be a fascinating realignment leading up to November. And, of course, today we had the meeting with Ned Lamont and Hillary Clinton, in which apparently she promised to hold a fundraiser for him and campaign for him. So she's beginning to see the writing on the wall.
Okay, we're going to have to break it there. Still to come, Clinton's welfare reform anniversary and the Plan B, FDA approval of the Plan B pill, and Republicans taking aim at Bush. But first, you're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Find more Left, Right, and Center programs and podcasts at kcrw.com.
Thank you. Welcome back to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Lawrence O'Donnell, sitting in as moderator for Matt Miller. Tony Blankley on the right is in Washington, D.C. Robert Scheer on the left is here in Santa Monica with me, as is Arianna Huffington. We're here at KCRW's world headquarters of Left, Right, and Center. The FDA has finally, after a torturous years of deliberation, approved the over-the-counter sales of the morning-after contraceptive pill to women 18 and older. This has provoked already a storm of protest by the religious conservatives who support President Bush. One quoted on the front page of the New York Times saying, "Let there be no mistake about it. Today's decision lies at the feet of President Bush and has created a lasting rift with the faithful who comprise a large part of his support base." Tony Blankley, this was no time politically for the president to run into trouble with his base, and it can't be something that Republicans running for re-election are happy with, since they're counting on that base to turn out to keep them in office. But isn't this another one of those situations where the base says to itself, why are we voting for them if they let this happen?
Maybe. It's certainly an indication, I think, to some extent, of a president who is sort of flailing some and sort of moving this way and that and looking with back and forth at different voting blocks. I'm not convinced that this is quite as dramatic as the New York Times found a relatively obscure anti-abortion person to quote on their front page. I've seen some other quotes from Tony Perkins and Jane LaRue and some of the more conventional people, and they don't like this, but they didn't talk about rifts at all. It's on the edge. I still think that most conservative Christian voters, if they come to the polls, will vote Republican. The question always is whether they're motivated to turn out, and the difference between a few percentage points difference in their turnout rate can be the difference between a good and a bad night for Republicans.
Arianna, there's a peculiar element to this particular story as it relates to the president in that he's actually given a very simple declarative sentence outlining his position on it, which is, I support Andy's decision, which is what he said on Monday in his press conference, which may have been one of the only responses that was easy to follow. So he has put himself in very clear support of the acting director of the FDA's decision, which was something, by the way, he didn't have to do. He could have said it's up to the FDA. It does feel to me, I don't have the grip on the Republican electorate that Tony Blankley does, but it does feel to me that this adds up to a serious political problem in trying to get that base out in November.
I think it does, too. I mean, you had Tony Perkins saying that they're going to file a lawsuit on behalf of the Family Research Council. You had Wendy Wright, you know, the president of the Conservative Concerned Women of America, saying that this would allow statutory rapists to buy the pill for the women they statutorily rape and so cover
it's
up.
An expensive pill. It costs, let's see, at least $40 to have these
but
pills.
I presume less expensive.
The one member of our show who checked and is actually stocking up.
Yeah. But, more expensive than a dozen roses.
Or than defending yourself in court. But, you know, for me, I would love to be able to have this debate beyond politics because I am the mother of two teenage daughters. And I am happy that the FDA made this decision, but I have still many concerns about how the long-term implications of this pill. I mean, we don't know. I mean, you know how long it takes normally to find out what the side effects of certain pills are, including the conventional pill. So I would like to be able to say, yes, good for the FDA. Now can we do some real research onto what the long-term effects are? And let's put as much emphasis as we can on programs that prevent pregnancy as opposed to programs that end pregnancy.
Bob Scheer, is this something you see as a problem for Republicans in November?
Yeah, I think it's a big problem. And first of all, I want to applaud the FDA because they're supposed to have made a scientific decision that it's safe to use. And this thing was being blocked because people were preventing a scientific decision. And, you know, we want to test things, but this thing had been tested and tested in other countries as well. And so hopefully politics has been taken out of it. But the problem for the Republican Party is they papered over an enormous difference between most Protestants and Catholics on this issue of birth control. Protestants favored birth control. The Bush family was the key sponsors of Planned Parenthood originally. The Protestants favored it as a way of keeping down the Catholic population, among other things. But they did not think it violated their notion of Christian religion. And so what happened was that and that's one of the reasons they don't want to do condom distribution and sex education and all of the sensible things you can do to avoid abortion. The Republican Party has been against those measures because, in fact, they like the emotional issue of destroying a live fetus and showing a fetus and working that emotionally. So if the union of a man and a woman does not produce this fetus, they're robbed of this big issue in the campaign. And that's what this Plan B does. It puts it back in the birth control arena. It puts it back with condom distribution and sex education and everything else. And yes, it will deprive the Republicans of what has been their most emotional issue for people to betray their class interest, to get poor people, particularly in the South who are Protestants, to vote for people who want to give tax breaks to the rich while screwing the poor. And so they hold up the fetuses in the jars and say, this is why you have to go for some Republican who's going to otherwise destroy your family life economically.
Speaking of emotional issues, Bill Clinton celebrated the 10th anniversary of welfare reform by publishing a triumphant op-ed piece in the New York Times this week in which he pronounced it a great success. The one thing that it has done indisputably is remove the issue of welfare from our politics. There is no longer an accusation suffered by Democrats that they are somehow soft on welfare and Republicans are tough on welfare. But, Bob Scheer, beyond that, what does Bill Clinton have to be proud of in welfare reform?
It's a despicable piece. A truly despicable piece. First of all, the headline is, I assume he approved it, How We Ended Welfare Together. He doesn't say how we ended poverty or how we even really cut poverty in any serious way, because he plays with the statistics. He gives a figure for 2000, which is when the term limits went in, and he says, wow, by 2000, welfare was down. Well, of course, they had to be down. They were kicked off. And then he says, and childhood poverty went down. Well, now the latest figures we have is that child poverty has gone up 12% since 2000, 12% since the limits were kicked in. Bill Clinton never mentions that 70% of the people on welfare were children. What has happened to those children? We don't know, because it's no longer a national program. We don't even have the figures. We don't even have the congressional studies. And I remember I interviewed Bill Clinton. He brags about Arkansas here. He said, go to Arkansas and see how poor people live in Arkansas. It's an absolute scandal. His Project Success program was a fraud. And he knows that, you know. And you had a situation when he came in where 44 states were experimenting with welfare. They could have tried all sorts of things. They didn't have to accept the system as it was. But what this guy did is something he told me when I interviewed him for the LA Times he would never favor, which was ending the federal obligation. That's what he did. He ended the federal obligation. Secondly, he said you have to spend more, not less money. They don't spend more money.
Tony Blankley, he in effect claims credit for authoring this piece of legislation. Now, I was working in the Senate at the time, and you were working for Speaker Gingrich at the time, and I think we both know that he didn't. The Bush administration authored a piece of welfare reform legislation that would have increased welfare spending by about $18 billion.
You mean the Clinton?
The Clinton bill, which was never advanced through a committee of the Congress anywhere. The Republicans authored their own bill, which cut welfare spending by $55 billion. That's a over $65 billion difference between the two positions. Clinton eventually signed that bill and now claims it as his own without having authored any of the provisions thereof. Do you want to take some credit for Speaker Gingrich and how this all happened?
Yes, surely. President Clinton made welfare reform a theme of his 92 election, but as you point out, he did not then work to advance legislation. We came up with a workfare-styled bill, and he opposed it and vetoed it twice in 1995, and then in 1996.
When he was running for re-election.
Coincidentally, the election year, yes. We offered it up a third time, and he signed it. So he gets the credit for signing it as president, and we're glad he did, but I don't think he gets any other credit for it. He opposed it. He really wanted the welfare issue for himself, and he was forced to share it with us.
Ariana, in Clinton's op-ed piece, he says he was widely criticized by liberals at the time, which is not true. It is part of his own vision of always being tortured by one side or the other. Liberals largely went along with this, and it was a rather shocking thing to watch when you consider in 1988, when Senator Moynihan authored a welfare reform bill that emphasized work, liberals had a serious problem with it, at least at the lobbying end, even though it got something like 95 votes in the Senate when it passed. What the Moynihan School of Welfare Reform wanted to do in those days, as he said, was make the welfare office an employment office. What this ended up doing was making the welfare office your final contact with the government before it abandoned you. And we now have in these studies a large number, possibly a million, of the desperately poor women who have not been able to get themselves into the workforce, who are now, as far as we know, just abandoned. And that was not something that anyone on the left was willing to do before Clinton became president, but then allowed to happen seemingly without objection.
Actually, I think this is such an important conversation to be having, and I very much appreciate Bob's outrage, because it is absolutely outrageous. It really epitomizes what was wrong with Bill Clinton, the abandonment of certain moral imperatives which were central to what liberalism was about. And you're right, most liberals went along. I mean, it was only Peter Edelman, you may remember, who actually resigned over the passage of welfare reform, was married to Marion Wright Edelman, among other things, and very close to the Clintons. But what happened right now is the abandonment both of the children that, as Bob mentioned, have actually in larger numbers than ever now been part of the poor in this country, and also the abandonment of this promise of retraining, of helping people find jobs, of helping them start new lives, of helping them get out of poverty and not just out of welfare. And the fact that this is barely a discussion in this country, that's another sacrifice we had to make because of Iraq. Unfortunately, the amount of energy that we would be spending discussing what happened after welfare is now being spent discussing what Khrushchev says and what Hillary Clinton is not saying on Iraq.
Well, we've run out of time for that last subject of Republicans criticizing the president, but I do think he's been criticized a bit on the show already today. It's time for our famed end-of-show left, right, and center rants with pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Bob, I'm going to let you take the first swing, and we have to be quick today.
Well, if what Clinton did was end the Fed, as you pointed out, he ended the federal connection with poor. We don't know where they are. If the federal government will not intervene for poor people and working people and so forth, who needs the federal government? We've always defined liberalism as somehow favoring a big federal government. What, for wars that shouldn't be fought, for big corporations that want all sorts of breaks? And to my mind, liberals have got to rethink what kind of government. Maybe we better have progressive state government and abandon this idea of the big Washington center.
Ariana, you're quickly.
Just very quickly, as I mentioned earlier, Ned Lamont met with Hillary Clinton today. And it's time that Hillary and every other Democrat supports the Democratic nominee, because the way that people are continuing to either silently support Lieberman or behind the scenes is completely unacceptable.
Tony Blankley, give me your fastest rant ever.
I'm very disappointed that Pluto was designated a dwarf and taken off the list of the nine planets, but perhaps now that he's a dwarf, he could be made the eighth dwarf.
Oh, I'm so with you on that one. That's all the rants we've got time for today. Thanks, as always, to Tony Blankley and Robert Scheer. Matt Miller returns next week. Why aren't we thanking Ariana Huffington in this script? We had help today from WAMU in Washington, D.C., and from Sports Byline in San Francisco. Our technical director is Ray Guarna, with an assist from engineer David Green. Sarah Spitz produces this program. I'm Lawrence O'Donnell. Thanks for listening, and join us again next week for another lively edition of Left, Right, and Center.
I wear pajamas.
You got pajamas.
We
know we need each other, so we
audio archives and podcasts of KCRW programs are at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about Left, Right, and Center, email lrc@kcrw.com. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by 89.9 KCRW Santa Monica and kcrw.com.